Our guest today is Vandana Ravindran. She is a computational biologist at the Oslo Center for Biostatistics and Epidemiology. Her research involves applying mathematical modeling, specifically complex network analysis, to understand viral interactions in relation to cancer. So I want to start by asking you, what actually is complex network analysis?
So as you know, that biological systems are really difficult to understand, right? And the idea is that it's not that you have this one gene, one protein, you have lots of genes and lots of proteins. And they have a sense of interconnectedness between them. That is, they communicate together. And how can we now model or understand such biological networks since there are so many connections? So the analogy is like, say, your friends and your group of friends. So if I want to know how connected you are, I start looking at your friends. So how many friends you have, your friends' friends, and that way I can build a network of your friends and like their friends and so on. Similarly, complex network is a way of representing such interconnected systems where I know there is some sense of relation between the two entities. And in context of biology, this would mean the relation between the genes, the relation between a gene and a protein, or a protein and a drug. So wherever I know that there is this relationship, I can construct these networks. And since because of the complexity, we call them as complex networks.
What kind of analysis was used before complex network analysis to understand these complex pathways?
There are lots of methods that are being used. It depends on the question that you're looking at. Like, there are groups that look at particular pathways and they model them as differential equations because they are interested in like a specific pattern or binding. So they'll study specific pathways. But what complex network or biological networks represent is more like a holistic and simplified way. So here, I don't look into the account of the activity, the amount of activity or the binding, the energy score or any of that. All that I look into is there a relationship between the two proteins of interest that I am studying? However, the connection, that is what we call as an edge, like that can have some biological meaning. So whether it is a binding, it's an activation, it's a repression, I can add weights to it. So it depends on what you are studying and whether what you your interest is, whether the model can be applied to it or not. Like, for instance, if you are looking at like an expression data, like microRNA or an RNA-seq data, you have lots of genes that show expression. You have your differentially expressed list. Now you want to know that, are they in the same pathways? So when you look at the pathways, then you know that protein A interacts with protein B. And so now you can represent these pathways as networks and study them. And the mathematical framework to study this network is from a very old mathematical field called as graph theory. So it has been represented as graphs where your nodes would be proteins, if it's social network, it's friends, influencers, and the connections is the relationship between these two nodes. And that's called the edge.
Right. So is complex network analysis the only mathematical framework useful for this kind of holistic understanding of pathways, or are there alternatives?
There are other alternatives. So this is not the only the only model. There are different models. There are so many multi-omics approach that machine learning approaches that take all your data together and then see if some genes are of interest, proteins of interest, and how you can predict the model and stuff. But what biological network representation does is that it tries to look at some sort of relationship. So say I have 10 genes of interest in a particular disease. Since I look at viral diseases, I have some genes that I know the virus targets in the host system. Now I want to know that, okay, the virus targets these host proteins. How is the relationship, or what could be the effect of this, and how is the infection mechanism? And so one simplified way of looking at it is I will start looking at the pathways and building networks around these host proteins that the virus targets. And once I have this small list, then if I am interested in drugs, I can take this list, look at the drug targets, and then this can go further for computational, like for experimental validation. Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of way of doing both. Like you have experimental data, you use systems approach, and then you come out with some hypothesis conclusion, and then you test to see if this fits into the model and what you've predicted out of your model, does it actually work or not?
Okay. Building on that, I read some of your work on applying network control analysis to understanding how HIV-1 and hepatitis C infect cells. And I read that you built a protein-protein interaction network for this. Why did you choose to map proteins as opposed to other substances or like genes?
The reason that I mapped protein interaction was that for HIV-1 specifically, before the COVID, I must say, that this virus had really good enough data set available. Mm-hmm. So the NCBI has this HIV-1 human protein interaction database, wherein they explicitly mapped which of the viral proteins interacts with which of the host proteins and what is the type of interaction, like whether does this inhibit the protein, does it activate the protein, or is it just a binding? And all of these interactions are obtained from experimental studies. So for us to actually see if the model that, or the model that we wanted to apply, in this case, network controllability, and we can talk about it later. The important thing was that we needed to have a really good data set. And so it was important that we curate this data set, and we were interested in protein-protein interactions. And that's why I started with protein interactions. But you can look at gene regulatory networks as well. But we looked at protein interactions and also focused on the signaling pathways, since that represents the like a sense of dynamics in terms of biology of the system.
What do you define really as a good data set? Is it a good signal to noise ratio, or good experimental validation of the data, or both?
It's both. It depends on the experimental validation on that data set, like what kind of experiments were conducted on the data set. Are there other publications that have reported that data set, like those interactions? So there are lots of different things that you consider when you want to model biological networks. Some of the databases are really good. They capture experimentally validated. However, they also capture some interactions that are computational. So for us at the start, it was that we did not want to have anything that was computationally predicted, but we wanted to have something that was more experimentally validated, like an affinity mass pull-down experiments, EC2 hybrid. So we know that in some experiment, this interaction has been reported. And so that gives us more confidence when arguing that, no, this has been validated in experiments, rather than, oh, this is something we just predicted. So that was the reason why we looked at the experimentally validated data sets.
With improvements in using deep learning algorithms for computational protein structure prediction, like AlphaFold, and better algorithms to predict protein-protein interactions, do you think that computational analysis will eventually be more reliable than it is now?
Yes, definitely. I think it would add a lot. And also the machine learning approaches for prediction has all increased. But however, it still comes back to, we know these predictions work. These are really good. And some of them will really help us. And then we can shortlist to get them tested in the lab. So that saves time, that saves money. And also we know what we are looking at.
Okay. But so you think that the computational prediction will never be able to replace actual experimental validation?
I don't think so that it will, it can replace, because both fall hand in hand. So
yeah,
one way or the other, you need a validation. So even though I would say that, oh, my computational method is really good, or what, it is a way of, validating, or like, a hypothesis-driven approach. So it cannot completely replace an experimental evidence, because like biological systems are so complex. So with more and more computational only helps us to simplify this complex systems, but you still need to know whether this really happens, the ground truth. And that has to be done through experiments. So I don't think there would be a place where a computational biologist can like just replace a lab person. Like they are still important and they have to go hand in hand. It applies same that only lab, I'm not saying that only lab experiments are really important. It's both ways, because computational studies help to understand better some of the experimental results. So they both have to be in balance.
Yeah, with all of these developments in AI and a lot of investor buzz in the applications of AI in biology, I think nowadays sometimes the importance of an experimental validation can tend to be forgotten.
That's true that there is this dilemma. But however, if you know, there was this really nice review with some of the scientists that came out with how in the current pandemic, where lots of AI models were used and they failed. Whereas when some of them really showed, but the reason was that there was really poor quality of data set and the models were not very well developed, or they were not shared well. And so some of these AI methods and the whole hype that maybe AI is the next big solution did not actually quite well show response in this COVID situation. So there was this really nice review paper that came out recently. No, I wouldn't say recently, a few. And also this MIT review on AI and how this whole bubble broke up, that it didn't really show what we were expecting for the the pandemic. So I think it's important that we should have this balance between the two.
Yeah, definitely. But coming back to network controlled analysis of viruses, what were the key findings that your analysis of the HIV and hepatitis C infections?
So just to briefly explain what the control part in this meant was. So network controllability was developed very well, and it's quite an old framework for engineered systems. And it's quite obvious that how do we gain control over the system? But in biology, it's like, what do you mean by control? Like, because the body is in homeostasis, right? So if you have nothing, then you are normal. But if you develop a disease, then it's like in a different state. And that was the analogy behind us for using control theory. So what what our hypothesis was that you have a normal cell, and when a virus infects a cell, then it changes the state. And so we wanted to look at this mechanism of infection and how the virus hijacks the host system, because a virus cannot survive on its own. It needs to infect a host cell in order to survive and replicate. And so we tried to use this network controllability framework in understanding how HIV-1 hijacks the host human cell. So for that, what we did was we considered a publicly available signaling data set, which has proteins involving in different signaling pathways. And then we created another network where we added these virus proteins, in this case, HIV, and looked at the interaction. So we created two networks, one that's only the signaling, and one, the signaling network with the viral interactions. And then we applied controllability analysis to both these networks and looked at the difference and similarities as to why these viral proteins and the host proteins that are targeted by them, how is it different in these two networks that we constructed? And to answer that, we looked at the different biological processes that these host proteins are involved in, the pathways they are involved in for HIV and for the Hep C, hepatitis C. And then we compared two different network models, controllability models, in answering our question.
So the two networks you created, one is a model of the infected cell and the other is a model of the uninfected cell. Is that correct?
Yes, yes.
Right. So what did you find the viral proteins to be targeting in your network?
So what we found was that the viral proteins target the nodes that are really important in control. And these nodes we call as the driver nodes. And that the reason is that these nodes are in a network frame highly connected. That is, they interact with a lot of other proteins. They are involved in different pathways. And also some of them are antiviral targets, like druggable targets. This is what we have shown in our paper. And recently with another colleague of mine, Alex, we also applied this to look at evolutionary genes and study how we could employ network controllability in understanding evolutionary relationship with genes and viruses.
Right. Did you expect the viruses to target the most, like to target the driver nodes essentially?
Yes, we did expect that they would target the driver nodes. However, what was more interesting is that since it was not that we just looked at the infected network and we saw that these were the driver nodes, we compared both. Mm-hmm. And some which were driver nodes in our uninfected network were no more driver nodes in the infected network. And that means there were a few more other nodes that came played an important role because the network structure changes. And most important thing to do here is that these algorithms that we employed are based on the structure of the network. So when I add more edges and more nodes, the structure kind of changes between one network to the other. Mm-hmm. And so what I have got as a result may not be the true when you study probably a cancer network or some other network. It may change the context because it's very different context that I'm looking at. But both the models that we applied were node-based. That is, the importance was given to the nodes of the network.
Okay.
These studies have shown how driver nodes have played important role in viral targets. And we also had observed the same thing. So this was a kind of a new framework that we tried to apply in understanding viral infection mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. Is there any significance in the kind of change in network structure between the infected and the uninfected state? Or is it just that like the nodes themselves are different?
No, there are certain significant changes, and that's what the network controllability helps us to identify. So the most important thing was that most network studies have reported that these high degree nodes, that is those proteins that have most connections, are really important. But in controllability, the other important thing is you not only capture the very high degree nodes, but you also capture the nodes that have like very minimum degree, like degree one or something, just one connection. And these are important because when we looked at these proteins, they were at different functional classes, like some of them were transcription factors, some of them were receptors. And so in terms of the virus infection, as we know that the viruses need receptors to bind and enter the cell. So we could capture these rather than only looking at high degree nodes, which are more what we suggest that are involved in later stage of infection. So the model tries to capture the receptors, the transcription factors, and all of these other proteins that are important in viral infection.
Mm-hmm. Well, coming from like a biochemistry background myself, I'm very used to looking at all of these pathways individually, like the molecular mechanisms. What do you think really is the benefit of seeing them all as interconnected and like the big picture of how a virus infects a cell?
Because as you know that one protein is not involved in one pathway, right?
Mm-hmm.
Proteins play roles in different pathways. And so if one pathway is triggered, it could have an impact on another pathway. And that's what network can represent, like showing you this interconnectedness. You can see how many proteins are part of the same pathway. What are they involved in different pathways? So the other way that these pathways are studied in networks is through modules like community detection and identifying modules of pathways, like small subgraphs within the network that represent a particular pathway. And then you can see the commonalities of how these proteins are interconnected between these pathways. And so that gives you a broader picture as to if I am interested in like targeting a particular protein, I can see whether it will have an impact on a different pathway than what I am studying.
Are there any therapeutics or drugs in trials or currently available based on complex network analysis? Or is using complex network analysis for validation something for the future?
There, we haven't done experimental validations in our paper. Our paper was more computational focused, but there are papers that have looked at certain drugs, especially in cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And in cell line studies, and they have shown some of them to be working in cell lines. So in our paper, we have not done any experimental validation, unfortunately.
Right. And do you think your findings have kind of general implications for understanding how all viruses infect cells, or like in terms of how it targets the nodes, or is it just specific to the viruses that you studied in the paper?
No, we believe that this model can be extended to study other viruses. We looked at HIV in detail and Hep C, but this model can be looked at to study other viruses as well. And we believe that it could be a good model than just looking at networks and like hubs and degree to look beyond that concept.
You mentioned using networks to model cancer signaling pathways.
Mm-hmm.
Why is network control analysis useful for this?
I think it's the same, like understanding how viral infection in terms of cancer as well, there is like mutations that occur within the cell. So it's in like, although this would be for a specific cancer type. And so it's important in when studying cancer that it's focused on a specific cancer of interest. And that the same principle applies that you know which other proteins involved in different cancer types. You can look at the gene data sets, gene expression data sets. You can look at transcription, like microarray data sets. And there are ways to construct networks out of these data sets. And then you can apply this controllability model and see if you can identify other proteins or genes of interest in that cancer, how they are triggered, how mutation can change. Where we focused only on node-based controllability, but there are other like where you can capture the dynamics in terms of adding, like looking at the edges, like changing the edges. So you can look at the edge controllability. You can look at node controllability by looking by another algorithm called as vertex controllability. One has to realize that each of these model has limitation computationally as well. So if it's too big, some of the algorithms, it's not possible to run them. So if it's a smaller network, there are maybe then the model that we study, there are other models that are more robust, like vertex controllability is quite robust, but that's for a smaller network. Very large network, it's quite difficult to analyze using vertex controllability. So there are lots of controllability models out there. However, one has to know like what each of these models have a different output. So it's easy to run in models and say, this is what we found out, but whether biologically it makes sense is something that you have to see whether that model can reproduce or not.
Well, given the large and like complex nature of networks in cancer, how are you still able to use complex network analysis in this context?
I mean, so you can you have 15,000 proteins with millions of edges that you can take and study, and you can computationally try to solve them. You can compute them, but how much sense that makes? So there are this, either you look at the global picture and you call this like the global network where you include every possible interaction, or you look at something that's more context specific, like for a defined cell line or for a defined few set of proteins. So for me, it's both. Like sometimes I feel that a global approach would be the right solution, but sometimes when we look at other systems, we feel that maybe we should be more context specific. So we try to look at protein interactions within a particular cell line, so we can make better meaning out of it and validate them in the lab as well.
Okay. In what settings do you think a more global network is better?
It's kind of a debate. Like some wherein you just randomly, so what happens most of the time is that when we collaborate with lab people in understanding, like, okay, our model has shown these targets and these drugs, could you please validate this for us? But when we take like everything into account and we get some interactions, we realize that if our collaborators in the lab use a specific cell line, those interactions may not be reported in that cell line. I mean, you may not see them. And in which case, it's not that the model is wrong. It's just that the model doesn't fit with the experimental validation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So if I was more keen in looking at certain drugs, and we know that in vitro we test them in a certain cell line, then we try to look at more cell line specific context. So we know that some of our targets and drug validation will fit in the cell line that they are studying, if that makes sense.
You mentioned different types of controllability analysis. Mm-hmm. What does controlling edges show, and what does controlling nodes show?
So when I say nodes here, it could be proteins or genes. So like controllability in like the node controllability is I'm looking at the protein or the genes in terms of control. So whether do I want to target drugs to them? Are they antiviral? Are they hijacked by the viruses? Are they involved in other different diseases? Edge is the relationship, the binding. So what happens if I remove this connection? So if two proteins are interacting and I remove the connection, then what happens? So that's the edge dynamics, looking at the relationship between the two, if that makes sense.
So how do you decide whether to use edge control or node control?
No, it completely depends on what you are looking at. Like in our paper, we were wanting to look at why certain proteins are hijacked by the virus. And so our focus was on the node. But if it was on the relationship about the inhibition or binding or things that more of the interconnectedness, then we would focus on the edge dynamics and not on the node dynamics.
I read some of your work on identifying critical regulatory genes in cancer signaling networks. Mm-hmm. Why did you study genes in this case instead of proteins?
Because here we were looking at a gene regulatory network in terms of mutations. Mm-hmm. And that's why the focus was on gene networks, like since we were looking at the mutations of the genes. Whereas in the viral studies, it was the proteins that were targeted by the viral proteins. So that's why in one, we looked at the gene regulatory network. In the other, we looked at the protein network.
Mm-hmm. And what did your analysis of these genes in the cancer signaling networks show?
In the cancer signaling network, we saw that most of the driver nodes that we identified were involved in different cancer types, and that and also in terms of the mutational studies, and that they were the genes that have reported mutations in cancer. The other thing that we had also identified was some of the these genes, I mean, obviously the protein counterpart, were reported as druggable genes in different databases. However, those two papers that was part of my PhD work and one of my postdoc work was not experimentally validated. And I would really like if I could validate some of those in experiments, by experiments.
So if you can identify the driver genes, can you understand steering both away and towards the healthy state? In other words, can you understand both the cancer mechanism and identify druggable targets?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, because the analogy here was that you have like a state that's, and then the mutation leads to cancer, and that's the disease state. So by targeting these driver nodes, can we come back to a somewhat normal state, like non-cancerous state?
Right. How do you know like which driver nodes to target or in what order they should be targeted in?
The study does not talk about, like we never validated the study on which order or how. We can only list that these are the targets and these are the drugs that we know that target these proteins. So then it can be tested in cell lines to see if they work or not for that given cancer type. So the network models don't tell in terms of the bioactivity of a drug and a target. No, it can only shortlist some of the targets and the compounds.
Right. Okay. So there's still, like here again, there's still that need for like a balance between the computational and the experimental validation.
Yes. Yes. You can like computationally try to look at like there are some machine learning algorithms that help you predict the toxicity or the bioactivity, but the network model that we looked at does not do either of them. So it only tries to shortlist and give you like a really nice set that we say that perhaps may work, and that these have been shown in other diseases. So this could be tried now in experiment and see if this works in a cancer or a viral infection setting.
Mm-hmm. And within academia, do you find it easy to do this collaboration between like your computational work and experimental groups, or is it something that's still quite difficult to bridge the gap?
Fortunately, I've been lucky that I have at least currently in my this postdoc that we have been able to collaborate with the wet lab scientist for our models, and that quite well goes hand in hand. But however, I think it also depends on your PI and how convincing can you like have collaborators with you to validate your model. Sometimes we try to write proposals and grants together where we do the computational part, and then the other group does the experimental validation for us.
Right. Would you say that this is usually like something that's done in academia, or do computational groups in academia work with like pharmaceutical companies or with industry to help them do validation?
There are some groups which work with pharma industries as well. There are groups that work within academics. So it depends how good you have collaborations with. So
right.
It just depends how good your group is and how well renowned get collaborators and gain their trust, most importantly.
Mm-hmm. So I guess kind of looking at the big picture, by using network control analysis to understand cell networks, there's the potential to see like the information flow in a signaling network. If you know how information flows in a network like that, could you technically control a biological system?
Yes, that's the icing that we would like. That's the goal. Like however I said, even if we can shortlist that some drugs by our method, like some targets that we identified are antiviral, then that's a really good method, so which can be employed to study other systems, other diseases. But everything depends on how much of information or how much of data we have and how reliable that data is. So the crucial is that, do we have really good data? Is it well curated? And then we can construct models, because it's like a model is not like I can put anything in a model and it'll give me some result, but how useful is that result? You don't know.
Right. So would you say the limitation or like the bottleneck in using network control analysis is the quality and availability of data rather than the algorithms and the computational methods?
I think that's just not for like network controllability. I think it's mm-hmm. for any computational method that if we have really good data set, well curated and even well described models, then it makes sense. Mm-hmm. But if one of them is poorly annotated or described, then it's quite, you don't know whether it's going to be really useful or not. I mean, it's not that computational methods don't have are error free. There can be some errors, but it's also that not all experimental experiments that have been in the lab are like error free, right? They can be small changes even when you do experiments, like the way you pipette or like your standardization protocol. So it's the same.
Mm-hmm. Right. And kind of, I guess, as we've discussed today, network control analysis is very interdisciplinary. Like you need to have quantitative and computational skills, but you also need to have a good understanding of like what it all means and the biological interpretation. Would you say it's better to be from a maths or a biology background, or like is either fine?
I think in my experience, either is fine. I don't have a math background. Like I did my math in school, and then I did my undergrad in chemistry, botany, zoology. Mm-hmm. I came back and started learning maths only in my PhD. So it really doesn't matter. But I think it's good to have both, because then you have understanding of the biology and also the computational method. And that kind of bridges whether you can then justify and also explain whether this computational model will work on your data or not.
Right.
And I think that's really important. And I kind of find that a really big advantage for me.
Mm-hmm. How did you decide after your undergrad that this was a subject that you wanted to go into?
I always liked coding and maths. So in my master's, I took up bioinformatics. And then my PhD was in complex networks, computational biology. And I did a lot of extra credit courses on machine learning, discrete mathematics, algorithms. So although it was a bit challenging, but I think it was really fun and nice. And that made me understand like how I can apply computational methods in biology.
Right. And lastly, do you have any general advice for younger scientists who want to get into the field?
I think it's fun. And if you really like computational stuff, like to code, understand, develop models, you need not be like a hardcore computer science to do that. All you need is interest. It's like learning any other language to speak. So, but the most important thing is that you should know some bit of coding. So you know to code, you have the interest in understanding computational models, then I think you can really balance well with your lab and your computational work.
Well, it's been really great having you on the podcast. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much. It was fun. Thank you.